Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the podcast. The VOC program is a deep dive into communist ideologies of all types. For this episode, I'm focused on Marxist-Leninist ideological roots of Chinese international behavior. This is an important subject because the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party is increasing, both in scale and sophistication. And the danger posed by what the military calls Beijing's ongoing low-level gray zone warfare is that it will eventually set in motion the next world war. This is something that cannot be easily dismissed. Still, millions of people around the world remain uninformed and as a result, unarmed ideologically in understanding the false nature of Chinese communism. It's absolutely essential to quickly grasp that the danger posed by China today cannot be dismissed or ignored as it was for some 40 years by global elites who were biased in not opposing Chinese communism over fears of being labeled as anti-communist. I refer to that period the anti-communist era, when Marxists and other political leftists aggressively promoted the notion that anyone who opposed communism was actually a greater danger than those who espoused Marxism-Leninism as a so-called scientific solution to humanity's problems. Let me explain here that there's nothing scientific about communism, and I plan to address this idea of so-called scientific socialism in a future podcast. For now, I want to talk about the course-correcting shifts in China policy now underway after a belated recognition that the 40-year pro-China engagement policy was a miserable failure. The new, more realistic view of the dangers posed by communist China are almost focused exclusively on Chinese behavior and the U.S. response. What we urgently need is to understand the intentions and sources behind Chinese behavior and the ideological forces driving those behaviors. Few experts have been able to identify key theoretical elements of Chinese ideology that guide both CCP foreign and domestic policies. This episode is inspired by a speech given by Miles Yu, who better than anyone I've known understands the ideological underpinnings of Chinese communist behavior. Chinese ideology is the motivational force behind Communist Party behavior, and we need to understand that. One problem has been the persistent doubt in the West about whether China should even be considered communist, and I've mentioned this in earlier podcasts. In China, it's different. Very few ordinary Chinese give much credence to communist ideology, and the nation, until the past few years, appeared to be intoxicated with the capitalist way of life in search of endless material possessions. But there is a critical distinction between the low acceptance of Marxist-Leninist, Maoist communist ideology among average Chinese and the CCP ruling elite's strategic thinking that is guided by a few basic but powerful tenets of Chinese ideology. This is an important episode, and if you listen to one episode of the VOC program, this is it, because I really lay out in very clear terms how the Chinese Communist Party has developed its own version of communism, of Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics for the new era. Despite the achievements of the Chinese people, the exercise of all political power in China remains exclusively the absolute monopoly of the CCP ruling an elite. This is an elite whose domestic and international policies are preponderantly conditioned by communist ideological dogma. Most Americans have missed understanding the role of ideology in China today based on a general belief in human goodness, since America was founded on the noble belief that all men are created equal. Judeo-Christian values infused early America like no other nation on earth, despite those values now being targeted, subverted, and replaced among the atheist Marxist left. Many who know the truth are afraid of pointing out the symbiosis between communist ideology and China's international conduct and domestic. The reason? They fear being accused of anti-communism. I long ago abandoned those fears, and I hope this podcast will help you to do so as well. The Chinese government remains dominated by powerful communist ideologies in the CCP Politburo, who have successfully exploited the American psychology with great success. They've done that through an elaborate influence and interference mechanism called the United Front Work Department. Using access to CCP leadership as a major lure, many key Americans who are influential in formulating and practicing our China policy fell into this trap, consciously or subconsciously playing down the degree to which China poses an ideological and adversarial threat to the United States and its democratic allies. This group of influential Americans helped develop what Miles Yu calls the cult of interlocutors. The preponderance of our China policy is based on developing personal, not principled, relationships with key Chinese communist leaders, while ignoring the deep ideological contradictions in the bilateral relationship. The difference between a totalitarian police state on the march around the world and the world leader in freedom, democracy, and free markets. We have to understand the ideological reality of contemporary China, a state that is ideologically obsessed. Knowing these ideological underpinnings is there supremely important, and it's important for countering Chinese communism. First, a note on the word ideology. It came out of the French Revolution. Originally, it denotes a system of ideas that form dominant principles under a government and how a society functions. In Chinese, the word ideology, or yixi xingtai, literally means mode of consciousness. That is often coupled with the word superstructure, or shangshen junju, Marxists and communists in the 1800s used ideology to mean political and philosophical underpinnings of the means of production and the material foundation of a society. Communist China uses this broader Marxist definition of ideology, mostly in a philosophical sense. But in contemporary CCP parlance, and to most ordinary Chinese, ideology as a political system of ideas simply means the domain of political awareness that conforms to the thoughts of Marx, Lenin, Mao, and other so-called correct communist leaders. For communist China, ideology is slightly different but broader in context with added Chinese characteristics. For CCP, ideology not only includes Marxist-Leninist tenets as the theoretical foundation for its political, economic, security, international policies and practices. It also means Chinese strategic culture, a culture deeply rooted in Chinese history, Chinese strategic heritage, traditional Chinese statecraft, and geopolitical wiles. The main purpose of defining Chinese ideology this way is to demonstrate the inherent logic and intellectual justifications provided by these two strands of global dominance by China under the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. Central to China's strategic self-awareness is the idea of superiority, the notion that China occupies a pivotal place in the world with a superior set of moral philosophies. For example, it seeks to infuse Confucianism, a much more refined culture, a more sensible system of political institutions. These include imperial examinations, residential registration, hierarchical, familial, and communal structures that stress duty, order, and collectivism. The result of Chinese ideology is a Sinocentrism that the CCP regards as giving China a moral and ethical role as the world's leader, not primarily through the way of the hegemon, Bao Dai, like it accuses the West of doing in the past 500 years with force and conquest. Mainly this is done through what they call the way of the king, royal road, or Bao Dai. As China did and is doing with moral persuasion and others' willing submission. Coercive diplomacy is necessary only when other peoples ungraciously fail to recognize China's moral superiority and cultural greatness. A 2010 bestseller in China was called The Chinese Dream. It was written by a Chinese military intellectual, Senior Colonel Liu Mingfu, of the Chinese People's Liberation Army, who is heavily favored by China's supreme leader Xi Jinping. He declared that China possesses a superior cultural gene and needed to become the world's leader. This Chinese sense of moral superiority is so deeply embedded in the CCP political ethos that made it impossible for the Chinese government to take moral responsibilities for many of its illicit activities against the West and the United States. According to this theory, the end does justify the means. Anytime the U.S. government confronts China with its malign behaviors, it is considered by Beijing a failure of the U.S. to recognize China's moral superiority, and China therefore feels greatly grieved by Washington's failure. China is emphatic and consistent in refusing to admit that the government has done anything wrong or immoral in stealing American innovation or intellectual property, in infiltrating U.S. government security networks, and other nefarious behaviors like bullying its neighbors. Therefore, China repeatedly demands that for it to make any concessions in relations with the U.S. must correct its wrong actions and stop challenging China's behavior as immoral or illegal. This was a feature of CCP approaches during the Trump administration and now during the Biden administration. The current administration craves military-to-military talks, and Beijing, in order to conduct them, has insisted Washington correct wrong behavior and doing things like ending freedom of navigation operations, surveillance of flights, and support for allies in opposing Chinese aggression. Closely related to this Sino-centric moral superiority complex is the uniquely Chinese concept of Qian Shua, or under heaven. Essentially, this is Chinese imperial cosmopolitanism, which points to a peculiar manifestation of China's power projection. China's promiscuous use of historical presence, real or imagined, is the basis for claimed vast territorial sovereignty far beyond its current borders. China claims others' territory and international commons, such as the South China Sea, as its own, citing centuries-old, sometimes millennia-old, but often having flimsy evidence of Chinese travelers to those places, as the main claims of present-day ownership or sovereignty, despite rulings against them by international bodies such as the UN Permanent Court of Arbitration. Sooner or later, if the current CCP logic prevails, the entire world will be falsely claimed by China as part of the socialist motherland under the self-proclaimed, ever-great, ever-glorious, and ever-correct Chinese Communist Party. This is a serious danger, and many note Supreme Leader Xi Jinping in announcing plans for CCP globalism and such notions as a community of common destiny for mankind. This is nothing less than world domination under Chinese communism. Combined with the imperial cosmopolitanism, there is a profound misunderstanding in the West about Chinese nationalism. Chinese nationalism is not about making China respected as an independent and sovereign country with a level playing field, like other nations. It is about making China the global hegemon of dominance and preeminence, as the CCP perceives China was once and rightfully deserves to become again. At the same time, Chinese propagandists deceptively assert that China has no imperial or hegemonic ambitions, something that is a blatant lie. There is a pervasive failure in the West in general, and the U.S. in particular, to recognize the fundamental symbiosis between communist theories and Chinese government policies and practices. George Kennan, the State Department Russia expert, got it right about a similar symbiosis in the Soviet Union in 1946 and 47. But few have gotten this right on China. Miles Yu is one who did. The truth is that CCP core leaders are among the most fanatic true believers of the communist cause. They are uniformly ideologically intoxicated by it. Mao is officially the fifth communist theorist saint after Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Vladimir Lenin, and Joseph Stalin. They even have a term for it. They call it the Ma En Li Su Mao in Chinese. Their statues still proudly stand in the PLA Museum in Beijing. And I was able to see them there in back in the 1990s when I traveled to China with Defense Secretary Bill Cohen. Supreme Leader Xi Jinping today is hailed by the CCP as the greatest communist theorist since Mao. Xi, who holds a doctorate in scientific socialism from China's prestigious Tsinghua University, is dramatically turning up the intensity of China's communist theoretical indoctrination programs at every level of society, and is demanding the entire nation, including the Uyghur detention camps in Xinjiang, Buddhist monasteries in Tibet, Christian churches, state-owned and private firms, schools and colleges, all levels across the country, must follow the Mao-era program toward ideological purity and thought correctness. From the perspective of national policy, it's imperative for us to understand the singular importance of communist ideology in China's governmental functions. While most countries have few foundational principles, for the U.S., they include popular sovereignty, limited government, separation of powers, checks and balances, and federalism. Today's China, by contrast, still adheres to the official PRC foundational principle laid out by Mao Zedong in 1954. It states simply, "The force at the core that leads our cause is the Chinese Communist Party. The theoretical foundation that guides our thinking is Marxism-Leninism." In the 21st century, Marxist theories have gained even more prominence in China. Enabled by revolutionary information technologies, the Chinese Communist Party is saturating China's public and private spaces with intense and ceaseless nationwide indoctrination campaigns, extolling Marxism, Leninism, and the thoughts of major Chinese communist leaders. Xi Jinping's relentless supreme instructions to the nation include his incantation that we must uphold Marxism, firm up and further build the ideal of communism and a shared ideal of socialism with Chinese characteristics. So, what are the central components of the CCP's Marxist-Leninist theories currently guiding domestic and international behavior? There are basically five key tenets that I'm going to go over now that are at the core of Chinese communist ideology. First and foremost is the Marxist-Leninist political philosophy of an epic struggle between two political systems. For the CCP, struggle exists at every aspect of China's foreign and domestic policies, something George Kennan identified 70 years ago within the Soviet leadership as the most potent source of Soviet conduct. Because of this theory, all government actions by China, for example, aggression against neighbors in nearby seas, the Belt and Road Initiative, and others, are simply separate battles in its ideological war against international capitalism and imperialism led by the United States. That is not only powerful, but also uncompromisingly determined to undermine China's socialist system with or without the use of disguise or covert cover. Virtually every CCP command instruction for these actions are framed in the context of such an epic struggle. They use phrases such as Daozhong, or struggle, or Zhangshang, battlefield, battle positions, Zhengzhu, strike or charge. These concepts show the CCP's overall mindset of this epic battle as a matter of life and death, or as Australian sinologist John Garneau put it, a matter of you die, I live. In Chinese, it's called Ni Su Wo Huo. Xi set this in motion in October 2017 when he called for the world socialist triumph in the concept he calls national rejuvenation under the Chinese Communist Party. Every party member must fully appreciate the long-term, complex, and onerous nature of this great struggle. We must be ready to fight, build our ability, and keep striving to secure new victories in this great struggle. Second is the CCP tenet of an insidious peaceful evolution conspiracy. This states the key ideological enemy instigated by international capitalism led by the United States. The essence of this alleged plot, according to Beijing, is to change the communist system in Beijing through ideological, cultural, economic, and spiritual infiltration of Chinese society, what Beijing calls a smokeless war of bourgeois persuasion. This is indelibly infused into CCP thinking and action, involving an enormous whole-of-government undertaking to stem this alleged plot. Massive internal indoctrination is designed to force China's masses, especially its ruling and educated elites, to adopt a siege mentality that points to the West in general and the United States in particular as waging a sophisticated anti-China containment strategy to impede socialist China becoming powerful and consequential in the world. The failure in the United States to adequately understand CCP fear and paranoia regarding this peaceful evolution is the primary reason our prolonged, naive, and failed engagement-centered policy over the past decades has failed to reform China. The CCP never fully accepted America's engagement policy narrative. On the contrary, all Communist China's leaders regarded virtually every aspect of U.S. engagement with China, including cultural, academic, political, diplomatic, economic, and military exchanges, as part of a subversive anti-communist peaceful evolution conspiracy. Xi Jinping warned that Western countries' strategic calculation to contain our country's development will never change. They will never want a socialist country like ours to carry out a smooth, peaceful development. No matter how hard the U.S. tried to convince the CCP of an absence of a China containment policy, the party's ruling elite never treated America's goodwill and engagement as anything other than part of the insidious Washington-centered anti-China campaign. Why? Because it's based on the deeply held view of the Marxist-Leninist theory of uncompromising struggle between the two systems. It's ingrained within the CCP's ideological DNA. This ideological DNA has translated into specific whole-of-government actions by China. Third, China's communist theory of perpetual revolution is a great conditioning factor in Chinese behavior. Karl Marx did not give a deadline for the demise of capitalism. In fact, by the time he died in 1883, capitalism was thriving as world communism was waning. As Western nations slaughtered themselves in World War I, Lenin revived Marxism by pronouncing that capitalism had reached the last stage in the form of imperialism and had become moribund, struggling and decaying. But Lenin's prediction didn't materialize, and Mao Zedong came to the rescue with his idea of proletarian revolutionary theory of perpetual revolution. In Mao's communism, the epic struggle against international communism will be a very long fight, requiring communists to be mentally prepared for a long haul and become more systematic and methodical. But most important, Chinese comrades fight all the time without stopping. This strand of thought is the unique Chinese contribution to the pantheon of communist ideology. It has become a deadly weapon in the aforementioned struggle of two systems because it has been formulated into a major Chinese strategy against the West, especially the United States, in the age of gray zone competition. The United States has not yet adapted to the Chinese way of perpetual revolution in its China policy. We tend to believe in a clear demarcation line between kinetic open war and a soothing, if bumpy, peace. Therefore, in order to avoid kinetic war with China, U.S. leaders devote much time and effort to seek peaceful, gentlemanly agreements and pledges from the Chinese leaders, either through presidential summits or prolonged and often fruitless negotiations and talks. And these agreements are systematically violated or ignored by the CCP, like the promise of Xi Jinping not to militarize disputed islands in the South China Sea. Those islands are now armed with anti-ship and anti-aircraft missiles that threaten trillions in trade through those waters. These summits and deal-making talks prevent the U.S. from taking any kinetic or offensive actions against China because they happen in peacetime. But from the Chinese perspective, there is no clear line between war and peace. China is in battle mode every minute. It's just that the battle takes place in different forms and on different battlefields, often in the gray zone or information warfare. That's why China never stops conducting cyber attacks and intellectual property theft, despite agreements and pledges. This is because war against the adversary must be happening all the time, in a perpetual struggle, as Mao repeatedly instructed. This communist theory of perpetual revolution creates a powerful, ideologically lofty goal, purportedly for the ultimate good of all mankind, a goal so lofty and glorious that all means to reach it are therefore justified, without any moral or ethical limits. Others are open in broad daylight, exploiting the openness of Western society with an influence and interference grand scheme so vast that the West has shown no effective response for it. This is the CCP's gigantic international influence and interference system known as United Front Activities that specialize in influence and interference operations on a grand scale. The network has penetrated into key parts of the West, especially in Europe and the United States. The fourth ideological tenet of the CCP is the Leninist tenet of the weakest links of international capitalism, and the CCP's corollary to this Leninist theory. Marx predicted the breakthrough for world communist revolution would start in the most advanced industrial capitalist societies, but it never materialized. One of Lenin's most recognizable theoretical contributions was his revisionist view of Marxism that declared, contrary to Karl Marx's logic, international capitalism will be broken first at its weakest links. In less developed countries such as Russia, China, Africa, Latin America, and elsewhere. Because most of these less developed nations were still under Western colonial rule, therefore Lenin reasoned that anti-colonialism must be part of the worldwide communist revolution, and the Soviet Union would therefore support national liberation movements in places such as French Indochina, China, and many other countries in the weakest links of the capitalist West. Mao took Lenin's idea further by developing his own branch of weakest links theory. This is the countryside encircling the cities strategic thinking. That is to say, the Chinese Revolution would not start in urban areas where enemies were strongest. Instead, communists would first concentrate on peripheral regions and the poor countryside areas to build strength economically, politically, and militarily. Then the CCP would encircle the political and economic power centers of the adversary in urban areas in a decisive revolutionary takeover. This happened in 1949. This, of course, requires strategic patience. Thus, Mao further developed his theory of protracted war as an overall Chinese military approach that is still in play to this day. In other words, Mao put into practice his own brand of communist containment theory against imperialist capitalism. This Maoist concept is also being used in America by Marxist intent on overthrowing the U.S. system. This is not just empty theory. It profoundly impacted China's behavior. Weakest links strategic thinking permeates today's Chinese high command and dictates many of the CCP's key global postures and activities. The gigantic Belt and Road Initiative and the egregious genocide of millions of Uyghurs in Xinjiang and the repression of Tibetans are predicated on the weakest links communist theory. China's leadership believes the U.S. anti-China camp has formed a tightening noose around the neck of the rising socialist motherland through all sides of China's land and maritime borders. It is all part of a grand scheme of containing China. The massive infrastructure and influence program aims to grab the global weakest links of the U.S., notably Central Asia and Africa, that are often referred to in today's China as the CCP's countryside. Beijing hopes will become base areas for encircling imperialist centers in North America and Europe and ultimately produce a global takeover by morally and ideologically superior China. A Chinese dream, I call it the Chinese communist nightmare, would therefore be realized. The last tenet of Chinese communist ideology is the CCP's unabashed, self-imposed position as the only savior for the global socialist cause. Common among all key party documents and policy pronouncements are repeated assertions that all major communist and socialist countries in the world failed or are failing, with the exception of China. There have been prolonged and intense propaganda campaigns that were launched to analyze how the Soviet Union fell and the end of communist experiments in Eastern Europe and other areas. The result is the most hated men in China's constant search for ideological purity are two former Soviet communist leaders, Nikita Khrushchev and Mikhail Gorbachev, both labeled as traitors to the socialist cause. Again, Xi Jinping announced, "The political system of socialism with Chinese characteristics is a great creation of the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese people." He insists Chinese Marxist-Leninism is correct. Through this program, you have learned how it is false in both its Marxist materialism and historical determinism. What Xi means is that China wants to subjugate the entire humankind by imposing socialism with Chinese characteristics under rule by the hated Chinese Communist Party. These two strands of Chinese ideology, Chinese strategic culture, and communist theories are the theoretical and philosophical sources of Chinese communist behavior. The two strands are integral and intertwined to form one unitary Chinese mentality. Sino-centrism is the driving a global ambition to rule the world with a superior Chinese moral and institutional system. Marxist-Leninist theories provide China an epic, endless, uncompromising struggle against adversaries, chiefly the United States, on a global scale. Both elements make false promises of an historic end to human suffering through Chinese salvation. Both further predict a deliverance from the miseries of self-enriching alienation incurring by a bourgeois international order led by the United States. In other words, both strands provide the CCP with a powerful vision and a justification for global dominance. But a future world under Chinese communist rule would sound the death knell for humanity. It will end all true efforts to achieve world freedom, democracy, justice, and prosperity. Instead, it would bring a world of catastrophic proportions. Xi Jinping, a few years ago, admonished his comrades in China to fully grasp the urgency of the epic struggle between China and the rest of the world. He said, "The wheels of history roll on. The tides of the time are vast and mighty. History looks kindly on those with resolve, with drive and ambition, with plenty of guts. It won't wait for a hesitant, the apathetic, or those shy of a challenge." That's a call for action on behalf of the Chinese communists. We must be ready to challenge and devote all our energy and resources into countering and defeating the expansionist ideology of Chinese communism. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. The counterproposal section of the podcast is significant for going beyond a critique of communism and offering the kind of solutions to the problems of humanity that Marxism-Leninism offers but can never deliver because of its failure in both economics and philosophy. It is by offering real solutions that ultimately communism and Marxism will be defeated ideologically. The VOC worldview, as I call it, is a God-centered, effective critique and counterproposal to communism. The worldview is based on the spiritual teaching of the late Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who brought forth new understandings about God, humanity, and the universe that are real and true. This powerful new truth is the ultimate antidote for atheistic, anti-human communism and Marxism. The behavior of every society is determined by its view of humankind. Nazism, for example, had a certain view of humans that led to the Holocaust. Social Darwinism has a certain view of humanity. Communism, too, has a certain view of humanity. A key tenet of the VOC rebuttal of communism is the role humans play in communist ideology. Essentially, communism maintains that humans are a product of the environment. Homo sapiens, in this view, are a species that emerged as a result of environmental pressures. In addition, individual men and women exist from environmental factors, according to the communist view. In response to environmental factors, a person will develop a certain type of character. This notion has given rise to Marxist ethics. A person is good or evil based on his or her economic formation. That's why, for example, when Chinese communists took over China, they exterminated all so-called wealthy peasants who were regarded as irredeemable under communist ideology. Those put into forced labor were to be re-educated through the environment of labor camps, where it was asserted their character could actually be changed. Also in China, those perceived as opposed to CCP ideology or voice opposition to it are ruthlessly repressed, either with imprisonment in the Laogai, as the prison labor system is called, or with direct execution. Under communist ideology, this category of people is treated with two methods, reform or re-education through prison labor, or they are regarded, as I said, as irredeemable through execution. The Marxist worldview believes economic alienation is the essence of evil. In other words, private property is the cause of evil, and when the economic system is changed, a regeneration of humankind would occur. The communist view of humanity is as follows. Humans are an advanced animal. In the communist view, humans are ape-like animals that have undergone a unique process of development. Second, humankind is matter in motion. Communism says humans are matter in motion, nothing more. This becomes the justification for an allegedly scientific program for regeneration and the perfection of mankind. The ultimate objective of communism is just that, the regeneration of humankind, the perfection of humans. The first step in that program is to put the communists into power because it is they who understand the laws of history. It is they who can create the proper environment for the regeneration of humankind. This is the basis for Mao's dictum of seeking truth from facts, which is now being espoused by current leader Xi Jinping. The communists claim to know the truth and that truth must be kept from all others until the ideal can be created. This practice of communism is a crime against humanity for which it must be held to account. Now, what would happen if the Chinese communists conquered the United States? There would be no restraining their power. Communist strategists have even speculated that two-thirds of the United States population, more than 223 million people, would have to be destroyed based on the communist belief that the capitalist mentality is so deeply ingrained here. In reality, humans have a more than biological life. The Bible speaks of life in a special sense. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. That's from John chapter 5, verse 26. Clearly, this concept of life refers to something other than biological life. Life in this sense refers to humans' unique ability to commune with God. The real life of humans is the spiritual life. The body is basically the vehicle for the spirit. A human is a spirit that is in a that and that spirit has a body. This is the meaning of a human as a divine being. The purpose of humans is transcendent of this world because the human spirit comes from God and destiny of all humankind. The destiny of all humankind is to leave this world and dwell with God for eternity. It is only here that we find the philosophical foundation for human rights and human dignity. Each person is a child of God. A crime against any human being is a crime against God. For certain, this explains the best possible critique that can be made against the exploitation of workers by capitalists, or the destruction of all middle-class Chinese in China, or the exploitation of the Third World by imperialists. When the reality of men and women being in a relationship as children of God is understood, the mistreatment of one human being by another can no longer be tolerated. Today, it is truly sad that many idealistic people who have become disillusioned by hypocrisy in the West are supporting Marxist critiques that denigrate humankind. Every effort must be made to encourage practicing God's truth about humankind that elevates humans to the highest possible level of dignity and esteem, at the same time strongly condemning injustice and exploitation. Now, let's examine the purpose of life. Humankind was created with a definite purpose. When that purpose is fulfilled, we experience a feeling of happiness. We cannot be happy unless we are fulfilling that purpose. In the context of the purpose of a human being, a person is created to love God and to give joy and satisfaction to Him. When we are able to commune with God and to give genuine joy to Him, we experience a true happiness that has been described by the saints and the great spiritual teachers. These same teachers consistently taught that the most important way of showing love for God is by learning to love people as brothers and sisters, the children of God. By loving God and our fellow humans, we are able to fulfill the purpose of our lives. This is like a violin making the most beautiful music. Today, many people are desperately seeking to experience happiness, but frequently, the more they try to be happy, the more unhappy they become. This is due to the nature of happiness itself. Happiness cannot be approached as a goal. Happiness must be seen as a reward bestowed upon us when we fulfill the commitments that we make in life. So, what are the various aspects of human? I spoke in earlier podcasts about God's characteristics of internal character and external form, as well as masculine and feminine. These characteristics are most fully manifest in human life. There are men and women, as well as mind and body. In addition, every human being has a spiritual and physical aspect. The physical aspect is subject to certain physical laws. The spiritual aspect is subject to certain spiritual laws. The physical aspect is temporal. The spiritual aspect is eternal. Physically, each of us has certain mechanical or animal aspects. Spirituality, humans were made in the image of God. Physically, we are subject to instinct. Spiritually, every human being has a divine mind. So, what is the object? The physical aspect. What part is subject or primordial? It is the spiritual aspect. If the solution to the human problem is to be found, the whole person must be included. That is, both the spiritual and physical aspects of humans must be part of the equation. The causal dimension in human life is the spiritual dimension, and yet it is this dimension that is too frequently ignored or de-emphasized, or in the case of communists and atheists, completely denied. Marxism, for example, treats the spiritual aspect as a product or function of the physical. Marxists try to deal with the human history and human problems exclusively through material terms. In doing so, Marxists invited failure. The VOC worldview is critical to understanding humankind and finding real solutions to the problems facing the world. To summarize and enlarge on what I've said so far, humans reflect God's image. God created humans in His own image. A human is like a mirror reflecting the image of God. When God sees a human, He is looking at Himself, just as parents often see themselves reflected in their children. In reality, humans are a visible manifestation of the invisible God. God's entire creation is the manifestation of His invisible self in producing a visible, substantial form. Therefore, every creation is a visible manifestation of the invisible God. Among all creations, humans are supreme. God projected Himself into a being capable of responding to the entire range of his emotion. God has given men and women unlimited potential for dignity and value. For this reason, men and women are in reality kind of second selves of God. In the words of the Bible, ye are God. Men and women exist in a relationship of sons and daughters of God. God created men and women in the most intimate and closest relationship with him. All humankind is created in the position of sons and daughters to God, and the relationship between God and his children is one of love. Since all humanity comes under one Father, we must love one another as brothers and sisters. All humankind is one family, and the parent of that family is God. Our identity as God's children transcends race, nationality, and culture. This is the most fundamental truth that is the key to recognizing the fallacy of Marxism-Leninism and offering the true solutions to the promises made by communism for an ideal world that can never be achieved in an atheistic system. Humans cannot seek out or achieve any greater or more permanent title than the title of son or daughter of God. You cannot honor any fellow men or women in any better way than to respect them as sons and daughters of God. This is the foundation of true peace and harmony among humans. This is where human rights and dignity originate. Another truth for this counterproposal is that humans are eternal beings. People were created as eternal beings just as God is eternal. As the laws of creation explain, God created humans for two dimensions. One is the physical self, the other is the spiritual self. At the same time, God also created the world in two dimensions. One is the physical world, and the other is the spiritual world. Humans alone live in both worlds. There have often been great misunderstandings regarding the term eternal life. Some believe that humans are supposed to live on earth forever. This view holds that because of the fall of the first human ancestors, death came about. However, we need to recognize that there is a great deal of evidence regarding the existence of a spiritual world. I discussed some of this earlier in debunking Marx's view of humans. If God intended humans to live on earth forever, we would have no need to create a spiritual world. Furthermore, despite all advances by science in the past 100 years, there remains no physical being capable of living forever. The VOC worldview declares that humans live in two distinct worlds. The physical body of all humans exists here on earth in the physical world, and the spiritual self will reside in the spiritual world forever. The spiritual body and spiritual world are made from spiritual elements. Between the two worlds, the spiritual and physical, the spiritual world is subject in the subject position, and the physical world is in the object position, much as the mind is subject and the body is object. The two worlds are identical, except the spiritual world is actually more real than the physical world. That's because it is the world of eternal existence. For this reason, the Bible refers to the physical world as a copy and shadow of the heavenly sanctuary. That's from Hebrews 8:5. Today, the greatest source of problems in society comes from the reality that men and women do not realize the spiritual world exists and that they will go on to live there forever. As a result of separation from God, humans do not understand that during their lives on earth, they must prepare for the next and ultimate stage of life. I'll continue this discussion in the next podcast, and I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's gertzfile.com, or at the book site called deceivingthesky.com.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the news portion, and for this section, I'm going to present a recent analysis that really looks at the roots of Xi Jinping thought. That's the latest iteration of Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. And it was based on an article that appeared in the Foreign Affairs Journal, or the journal Foreign Affairs, written by Rana Miller. He's a Harvard Kennedy School and author of China's Good War, How World War II is Shaping New Nationalism. In 2023, Hunan TV, China's second most watched television, unveiled a series called When Marx Met Confucius. This is really about how two thinkers, Confucius, met Karl Marx, and they looked at each other and discussed the nature of politics, arriving at the conclusion that Confucianism and Marxism were compatible, and that Marx may have subconsciously drawn his theories from a Confucius well. Yeah, that's, again, the Sinocentrism that Miles, you talked about. In one of these episodes, Marx noted that he and his companion share a commitment to political stability, adding that in reality, I myself was Chinese for a long time, suggesting that his thinking had always been harmonious with traditional Chinese worldviews. The series was backed by the Chinese Communist Party, and that tells you it's the official view. And it was formed in part by Xi Jinping's sweeping political project to basically revitalize Marxism-Leninism in the country. Since taking power in 2012, he's made it imperative for the Chinese people to understand Chinese ideology, which he calls Xi Jinping thoughts. Bureaucrats, tycoons, pop stars were required to endorse it. Students had to learn it in school. CCP members had to use a smartphone app that regularly communicates its precepts. And key to Xi's thought is pairing Marxism with Confucianism. In October 23, he declared that today's China should consider Marxism its soul and find traditional Chinese culture as its root. Xi's efforts to redefine China's ideological underpinnings feel increasingly urgent as a slowdown in the economy has fed doubts among the entire country and the world about the so-called Chinese advancement. He leads a country whose economic might is far more respected than its form of government. China now has won its place among the world's major economies, but it remains an aspirant within the international order. To the frustration of Xi Jinping and Chinese leaders, Western countries are reluctant to accept China's global influence unless China conforms to modern liberal values. But his attempted synthesis of Marx and Confucius has prompted bafflement, even mockery, among observers outside and inside China. China's formative early Marxist thinkers, in particular, generally condemned Confucianism. They saw it as a philosophy that stresses hierarchy, ritual, and a return to the idealized past. Mao and other Chinese Marxists believed Confucianism was theoretically incompatible with Marxism, which celebrates revolution and perpetual change, and that its practical influence on politics had made China weak. Confucian thinking, in the communist view, generated a moribund bureaucracy that failed to adapt to the challenges of modernity. This renunciation found its ultimate expression in the disastrous Cultural Revolution that killed millions and nearly destroyed the entire country from 66 to 76. That's when Chinese Red Guards dynamited the philosopher Confucius' tomb before hanging the naked corpse in front of it. In 2004 book, The Rise of Modern China Thought, his magnum opus, Wang Hui, a scholar of Chinese language and literature at Tsinghua University, implies that China's embrace of Marxism did not, in fact, arise from a wholesale rejection of Confucianism. This is, the Sinicization of Marxism-Leninism. By the end of the 19th century, economic failures and defeat at the hands of the British in the Opium Wars brought China to the point of an existential crisis. After China was forced to sign treaties with a host of rising powers, including Japan, Russia, and the United States, it appeared that it might simply be unfit to flourish in the modern world. One potential conclusion was that the Chinese traditions were antiquated and had to be jettisoned in favor of Western ideas, including both nationalism and Marxism. Wang argued that it was a crisis of worldview. Scholars have long asserted that the ways in which Confucianism was applied to 19th century Chinese politics had left the country sclerotic, unable to engage with the modern Western ideologies such as capitalism, liberalism, and nationalism. Confucianism's emphasis on tradition and respect for hierarchy had justified an entrenched, sometimes corrupt bureaucracy that failed to respond deftly to foreign invasions or internal revolts or maintain a sufficient tax revenue to maintain security and infrastructure. But this kind of stagnation is not inherent in Confucianism. In fact, Confucian thinkers often relished encounters with foreign ideas, incorporating or synthesizing them to adapt China to new historical conditions. Modernity also did not present them with an unanswerable challenge, setting up a clash between old and new ideas. Then there were the New Text Confucian thinkers that were open to Marxism. In 1925, the author Guo Muro wrote about Marx's entering the Confucius Temple in a short story that partly inspired Hunan TV's new series that I mentioned earlier. In a 1939 text entitled How to Be a Good Communist, Liu Shaoqi, a central figure in Chinese Communist Revolution, referred to communist virtues in phrasing more Confucian than materialist. China now boasts immense economic and military power. There are no meaningful threats to its national sovereignty. But like many countries on the rise today, China doesn't feel a sense of ownership over the world's international norms, which are largely created by the West and the 20th century. Chinese elites believe their norms and these Western norms and their universalist intellectual premises have largely been imposed on China and are inferior. And despite China's strength, it's increasingly afflicted by a sense of crisis. The sentiment is partly a reaction to material circumstances. China's urban youth unemployment is now at 20% or higher, and a growing rural-urban inequality are rooted in economics. So, too, is the difficulty that Chinese families now have in meeting their mortgage payments or coping with inadequate health care and pensions. China's malaise today is also sociological, especially for young people. It can't be resolved by economic fixes alone. The recent era of spectacular economic growth generated a self-concept among Chinese citizens. China is a daring rising power, and being Chinese means being on the cutting edge. The core of that understanding is now being challenged. China's astonishing growth trajectory appears to have crested, leaving not only people's bank accounts hollowed out, but their sense of identity as well. Today, the word that many Chinese professionals often use to describe themselves is depressed. On social media, young Chinese people express this disillusionment and disaffection, declaring that they are lying flat, tang ping, or rotting away, bai lan, and the COVID-19 lockdown period eroded trust in the state. More and more young Chinese professionals in business, academia, and the media are confronted with restrictions that they find baffling. For instance, many Chinese students are eager to study abroad, but many are also told that if they do so, their rise in Chinese bureaucracy will be hampered. As China's population starts to age, young people are becoming aware that the cost of looking after elderly parents will fall heavily on their shoulders. China may well be able to follow Japan's track by adjusting its domestic economy to create new service sector jobs and concentrating on elder care. Such a China could be a decent place to live, but it would not provide the heroic energy that underpins a rising power. This helps explain why Xi Jinping has begun trying to present a new ideology that seeks to fuse a Marxist view of society with a Confucian one. Marxism promotes self-criticism, and when applied to real politics, has tended to lead to purges. These are phenomena Xi wishes to avoid at a fragile political moment. On the surface, his synthesis may appear to be just an effort to defend himself and the party against criticism, since Confucianism prioritizes stability and respect for authority. Others say that Confucianism and Marxism may not be inherently incompatible. The effort to use traditional Chinese philosophy to face emerging challenges has a precedent. Mitter, the author of the piece in Foreign Affairs, wrote that he spoke to a student enrolled in a prominent school of Marxism-Leninism in China. "What does Marxism mean to you?" I asked her, he said. She explained that studying Marxism offered her a way of reflecting on her personal development. Marxism, she said, gave her a profound peace of mind. This is intriguing, the author said. What she described sounded more like Confucianism than Marxism. Perhaps she was simply absorbed in some of Xi's growing emphasis on traditional culture, but perhaps intuitively it seemed to her that elements of the two philosophies were compatible, and it was comforting to her to feel that her own culture had some answers to her generation's dispiriting sense of driftlessness. A Marxist worldview anticipates a future that continues to be shaped by dramatic changes and convulsive confrontations with, for instance, the United States or the liberal international order. A worldview formed by Confucianism can accommodate the idea that China will need more calm, predictability, and stability in the future, and that direct military confrontations would likely undercut China's own interests. Xi's efforts to synthesize Confucius and Marx will not work, in my view, because the fallacies and failures of Marxism are insurmountable, and no amount of bastardization will make the ideology work. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
Hi, friends. During the break, I'd like to briefly mention a little bit about my website, The Gertz File. It's gertzfile.com, and there you can find lots of information. I mentioned earlier my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also would like you to look at I War, War and Peace in the Information Age, which was my previous book, and this is a really important look at information warfare and what we need to do to counter it. I also have information, further information about the podcast, as well as information about the Gertz File Investigative Reporting Project, and all of my stories linked to the Washington Times.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by Miles Yu, someone I regard as among the most knowledgeable experts on Chinese ideology. Miles is director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute and was a key figure in initiating a major shift in U.S. policy towards China while working as a senior advisor at the State Department during the Trump administration. Miles, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill, for having me.
Let's talk about the current status of Chinese communist ideology under Xi Jinping. What has changed under Xi and what hasn't changed?
Well, what has changed very little. Xi Jinping considered himself as the sort of fundamentalist Marxist-Leninist. This guy had a doctorate in Marxism-Leninism theory from Tsinghua University. He believed that the Chinese version of communism has strayed a little bit, of course, during Deng Xiaoping's time and Jiang Zemin's time and Hu Jintao's time. They're still Marxist, but a little bit sort of on a sidewalk. So what Xi Jinping tries to do is to bring China to the right path toward communism. So he's much more ideologically indoctrinated. He tried to bring the whole nation into the fundamentalist Marxism-Leninism. You see this, that he's done this through a centralizing economic decision-making process, severely striking against non-state sector of economy, which is intrinsically related, connected to the international free trade system. And he also dramatically enhanced the degree to which the Chinese Communist Party is in charge of the whole nation. So the sort of functioning bureaucracy is pretty much not really functioning right now, because everything is centralized in the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, which is directed by the Standing Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, which is, of course, all loyal to him as the General Secretary of the Communist Party. So party plays an essential role right now. So he believes he's leading the socialist cause to the ultimate triumph.
Yeah, and he, as you mentioned, he's sharply strengthened this notion of the party state, where the division between the party and the government has been basically removed. So that's why people now refer to the ruling system in China as the party state.
Yeah, so basically 20th century and 21st century communist were all communist parties were essentially Leninist party. Leninism stressed a couple of things. Number one, the most important thing is the supremacy of the what called the vanguard of the proletariat. That means the party. So the party is considered as the vanguard of the proletariat working class, and the party is given enormous power and privilege. And that's why the party is a very essential in today's China. And you can say Xi Jinping is the ultimate party animal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Earlier in the podcast, I spoke about a speech that you gave a number of years ago when you addressed the key ideological tenets behind Chinese international behavior. And they include the notion of the epic struggle of two political systems, China's conspiracy theory of an insidious peaceful revolution, perpetual revolution, and then the Leninist adaptation of targeting the weakest links of international capitalism. Can you elaborate on any or all of these?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental view of world affairs from the perspective of the Chinese Communist Party is one of irreconcilable struggle between two political systems, two ideological systems. One represented by the always righteous, always glorious, always correct Chinese Communist Party against the other side, which is basically a world order dominated by the United States, and which is emphasizing on free market and political free expression and democratic institutions. So China basically stands on the opposite of that. When China was weak, so this epic kind of struggle was expressed in a slightly different way. That is that, hey, United States, you're strong. European, you're strong. You stay in your name, in your area. So you got your Monroe Doctrine in Western Hemisphere. And so eastern part of the Pacific, right? That's your domain. And let us China to be the dominant figure in, say, Western Pacific, East Asia, or Northeast Asia, or Southeast Asia. That was basically China's political expression when China was relatively weak. Now, Chinese Communist Party has completely jettisoned that idea, because they realized that in order to be the regional superpower that they wanted to be, and the United States would not allow that to be, because the U.S. has the intrinsic investment in Western Pacific. We have a lot of friends and allies. We have three treaty allies, as a matter of fact, Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. And in the area China wants to dominate are the international commons, such as South China Sea, Taiwan Strait. And those are all critical lanes of commerce. So China wants to dominate to become its own internal lake. So China realized that in order to even become a regional hegemon, China must defeat the United States, because the United States would never allow China to do that for the common good, right? Yeah. This is exactly what the Japanese were thinking. Japanese in the 30s and 40s, they wanted to be the regional hegemon, mm-hmm. and they occupy Southeast Asia, they occupy part of China, they occupy everybody. And they want the United States to stay neutral. Once they realize the United States would not allow that to happen, and then they contemplate the defeat of America, that's why you have Pearl Harbor. So this is basically exactly the same thinking. That's why China's strategy to win is really global in nature.
Yeah. How about this idea of targeting the weakest links of international capitalism? That's something they're doing as well.
That earlier I mentioned two pronounced features of Leninism. One is Lenin's contribution about the supremacy of the party, the vanguard of the proletariat, into sort of two Marxist theoretical pantheon. The other one is basically uniquely Leninistic. That is Lenin's idea of the weakest links theory, which is to say that Karl Marx predicted that the first wave of communist revolution uprisings would take place in the most advanced industrial countries, United States, the UK, France, and Germany. That's because that's where the capitalist exploitation was the most severe, and the workers will be really, really mad at the system. They'll rise up spontaneously. You don't have to really work for it. And that didn't happen by the time Lenin came around, because by the time you got labor union, your formation of a middle class, so people are basically, you know, fled to the arms of the labor union rather than the Communist Party. So that's why Lenin said, no, this is Marxism needs to be adjusted. Marxism, that is to say, the first wave of revolution most likely not going to take place in the most advanced industrial countries. Rather, it's going to likely to happen in the less industrialized countries, such as Russia, China, and other, well, that area of the world, now we call the third world.
Yeah.
So to do that, Lenin said, that's the weakest links. Those are the weakest links of international capitalism. So you got to strike at the weakest links over there. This is basically the fundamental theory that guides China. Mm-hmm. They're going to basically preoccupy areas where America is not predominantly influential, such as Central Asia and Africa and Latin America. Those areas were the primary targets of China's expansion to the globe, and the major mechanism to do that is the so-called Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah,
which was designed for that. It's a multi-trillion-dollar project. It's very ambitious.
Yeah. All right. In the short time we have left, how about you have pretty good sources and you have your ear to the ground on what's going on in China. What do most people in China think about this drive to revitalize Marxism, Leninism in China? What do they think about the party and what do they think about communist ideology?
This is the problem in the system inside China. Everybody knows that the communist theory is a lunacy. But the party, the state controls the information domains. They control your total access to information. So you do not have, number one, accurate information. Number two, you don't have the comparative framework of information sources. So you end up basically have no choice but believing, even sometimes being indoctrinated by their system. I'll give you one example. China has this capability of thinking there is a really well-coordinated international conspiracy against socialist China. So they can make any tiny incident a huge deal another piece of evidence of an international conspiracy. Lionel Messi, the Argentine soccer superstar, went to Hong Kong. He was injured, so he couldn't play. And China considered this as a part of the international conspiracy against China, because Lionel Messi, number one, is from Argentina. Argentina, you have the anti-communist, anti-socialist president right there, Javier Milei. And of course, Lionel Messi played in Japan a few days later. Say that's basically a deliberate choice by Lionel Messi. Most importantly, Lionel Messi belongs to the club in Miami. It's called the Inter Miami, which is owned by two of the brothers who had the Cuban connection. They said, that this guy is a wrong anti-communist. As a matter of fact, these two owners, the father was a CIA recruit. That's basically what Chinese state media said. The whole thing is just out of thin air. A lot of people in China believe that because they have no other choice but to watch and absorb this kind of information.
Yeah. Last question. What do we do? What What should the U.S. and the free world do to counter the CCP ideologically, like we did during the Cold War against the Soviet Union?
The communist house of cards will collapse if you know the weaknesses and vulnerabilities of that system. That communist theory, ideological intoxication, is strong and powerful, maliciously, by the way, only if there's no crack. So once there's a crack, once the one card at the bottom of the house collapsed, and then the entire mirage will disappear. So that's why most important thing is to increase pluralism inside China, and also most importantly, to make sure that we develop a relationship not only between the Chinese communist government and the Western capitals, but also we develop a relationship between Chinese people and the rest of the world. That's why the relationship with China should always be trilateral, not bilateral. So you have to work with the Chinese people. And the biggest fear of source of fear of the Chinese Communist Party is actually the Chinese people themselves. So I'll just end there.
Miles, thanks very much for doing the interview.
Thank you, Bill.
That'll do it for this episode of Victory Over Communism. Please tune in another couple of weeks for another podcast.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.